Hey there, it's Joshua. Just a quick note before we start the show. A lot of news has broken today and is still breaking. The Friday News Roundup, of course, was recorded earlier, so we discussed a lot of what's been happening, but not everything. So to stay up to date on the very latest, you should keep an ear out on your NPR member station or go online to npr.org. Thanks. This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Congress can be a raucous place, but the shutdown has made things especially heated, including between Republican Senator Ted Cruz of Texas and Democrat Michael Bennett of Colorado.
Okay, we get they hate Donald Trump. If anyone in America had missed that point, that they really, really, really don't like this man, their yelling and screaming and bellowing has made that abundantly clear. But just because you hate somebody doesn't mean you should shut the government down.
How ludicrous it is that this government is shut down over a promise the President of the United States couldn't keep. And that America is not interested in having him keep. This idea that he was going to build a medieval wall across the southern border of Texas, take it from the farmers and ranchers that were there, and have the Mexicans pay for it, isn't true. That's why we're here.
It is day 35 of the shutdown, and anxiety is growing far beyond the Senate over everything from payroll to patrolling America's airports. Federal lawmakers and the president remain in a stalemate. We'll explore the fallout from the continued shutdown this hour, as well as the other stories that may have us talking this weekend. Joining us here in studio is Kimberly Adams, a senior reporter for Marketplace. Kimberly, welcome back to the Roundup.
Thanks, Joshua.
Also with us is Rajini Vaidyanathan, a BBC News correspondent and anchor for World News America, who has been covering the shutdown effects in the Midwest. Rajini, welcome.
Good to be here, Joshua.
And a first-timer on the Roundup, Katie Rogers is a White House correspondent with the New York Times. Katie, welcome to 1A.
Thanks so much for having me.
Before we get to the shutdown, we must begin with a big story that broke this morning, really kind of in the wee hours of the morning, when a close associate of President Trump was arrested. Roger Stone faces indictment on 7 counts of allegations that he lied to the House Intelligence Committee during its investigation into the Trump campaign's ties to Russia. Mr. Stone is due in court this morning at 11 a.m. Eastern Time at the federal courthouse in downtown Fort Lauderdale. Kimberly, let me start with you. We've gotten to know a lot of Trump's associates through the Russia investigation, through the Mueller probe, and just the news cycle. Give us the basic backstory on Roger Stone.
Roger Stone, longtime, as you said, a close associate of Donald Trump, who was involved in the campaign, first as a sort of high-level campaign advisor, and then just sort of as a more informal advisor closer to the end of the campaign. This indictment, which I've got right here, it's a pretty thick one, you know, basically revolves around those WikiLeaks dumps of information about the DNC. How much did Roger Stone know and when, and did he coordinate with the Trump campaign about it? And the allegations or the charges here are that he knew a lot more than he told Congress when Congress was investigating this, that he lied about it, and that he tried to get other people to lie about it, too.
Now, Roger Stone has been something of a fascination, Rajini, for quite some time. He was the subject of a Netflix documentary called Get Me Roger Stone, which debuted in 2017, that detailed his very long political history as an operative dating back to Richard Nixon. Here is a clip of him from the documentary Get Me Roger Stone.
Those who say I have no soul, those who say I have no principles, are losers. I revel in your hatred, because if I weren't effective, you wouldn't hate me.
Rajini, that's kind of Roger Stone's charm? Is that the right word? I mean, if you hate the swamp of D.C., for many of his critics, he is the prime swamp creature.
He is. Longtime lobbyist, worked with Paul Manafort, former campaign chairman to Donald Trump. I watched that documentary, actually, when it came out. And one of the things that sticks in my head is seeing his tattoo, Roger Stone's tattoo of Richard Nixon, which was on his back, I think, as I recall.
Not a small one.
Not one of those.
In like a drunken night in Vegas. He meant to get this
he
tattoo.
He really does wear his politics on his sleeve or his body. But I just remember watching that and thinking, he is such a flamboyant character with so many layers. I thought I was watching a profile of a Hollywood celebrity, you know, who's been in, you know, films for decades. And in a way, I mean, all of this, if we just take a step back, though, Joshua, is just this is someone who was very, very close to Donald Trump. You know, we've got Paul Manafort, who I just mentioned, who I think is due in court today in Washington, D.C., who was very close to Donald Trump. You've got Michael Cohen, who's soon going to be starting a prison sentence, who was very close to Donald Trump. And though we've had the White House this morning, Sarah Sanders saying, you know, obviously, President Trump has not been implicated in any of this. When you take a step back, these aren't small bit characters. You know, we've done an article on the BBC where we've kind of looked at the Russia investigation as a kind of box set series. So it's kind of season one, season two, season three, season four. And, you know, in a way, Roger Stone.
What season are we on?
Four. Oh, yeah. Season four.
Not
maybe.
The last one, I think.
Exactly. But Roger Stone's just that character that just comes in and just steals the show.
I do think, though, Katie, it's worth kind of putting some perspective around who he really is in the larger scheme of this.
Sorry.
Melissa tweeted, "Here come all the celebratory tweets by people who hate Trump and are hoping it leads to him. After months of investigation and millions of dollars spent, it seems unlikely." Katie, I don't know if we know how likely or unlikely it is, and that's kind of the point.
Yeah, and I think if you look at what Sarah Sanders said this morning, what struck me about her reply on CNN. Well, first of all, it struck me that she was on CNN at all. The president has attacked CNN as the enemy of the people. So I was
right. I think she had
intrigued.
I think she had a Friday morning slot scheduled
perhaps,
on New Day that she decided
on
to
shut down. Yeah.
So then she had said, you know, none of this leads to him. Like the White House is really making sure to say this is going on, but none of it leads to him. But if you look at the indictment, you know, what the special counsel left open was who directed a senior campaign official to reach out to Stone to find out what WikiLeaks, which, as we all know, was supplied information by Russian-backed operatives, had that would be damaging to Hillary Clinton. So there's certainly an open question about who was directing a senior campaign official who appears to be Steve Bannon to reach out to Roger Stone. So there's this web that exists, and there's this piece of it, which is where there's an open question about what we know about the president's involvement.
Regini?
I just wanted to jump in. I watched that Sarah Sanders interview on CNN as well that you discussed, Katie, and she was part of the campaign. So mm-hmm. watching her say, I don't know what happened in the campaign, I have no idea, I'm not sure how people will buy that.
John Berman called her on that during the interview, because I watched mm-hmm. it too, and she kind of very much distanced herself from that. But that's kind of, Kimberly, the whole point of the exercise. This is so very entangled. And we should be clear, the Mueller probe is not just about Donald Trump himself. It's about the campaign and whether anyone in that whole aegis had anything to do with Russia's efforts to influence the election.
Right. And if you look at this indictment, they are laying out quite clearly that that there is an argument to be made that members of the Trump campaign were regularly communicating with Roger Stone about what WikiLeaks had and when it had it. And, you know, there was a back and forth, not just a one-way street. And that's going to probably be something that's going to ensnare a lot more people as this moves forward.
Let me get to two quick comments about this story before we move on to talking about the shutdown. Michael tweeted, "Cohen, Flynn, Gates, Manafort, and now Stone. Trump's inner circle is all going down. Then individual one comes last. Make America Russia free again." Individual one is the way that Donald Trump was referred to in one of the indictments against Michael Cohen from prosecutors in New York. And Mr. Lewis tweeted, "He'll be the best dressed guy in the pen," because Roger Stone is known for some rather flamboyant, but I'm sure he would say stylish fashion. Let's set Roger Stone aside, because there's a much larger story that affects far more Americans, and that's the shutdown, which is now in its 35th day. Katie, the negotiations were still kind of technically happening this week. There were two bills put forward.
Technically is a great word.
Yeah. Well, because there were two bills put forward with the goal of reopening the government. The Senate rejected both of them.
Mm-hmm.
Some, but not enough, Republicans showed support. Is there anything we glean from that this week, particularly which bill maybe got more support than the other?
Well, actually, the Democratic proposal to reopen got a surprising number of support from Republicans. Essentially, both failed, and we're back to where we started, which is lawmakers are saying now we can negotiate. It's just, if you're an American watching this outside of Washington, it's like it almost looks completely counterintuitive that let's vote on bills that we know are going to fail, and now we're hopeful that we can negotiate.
Thousands of teachers, nurses, counselors, and librarians got back to work on Wednesday in Los Angeles.
Proud to announce that pending approval, by the teachers, represented by UTLA and education professionals, and the Board of Education, that we have an agreement that will allow our teachers to go back to work on their campuses tomorrow.
That was LA Mayor Eric Garcetti announcing an agreement between the union, United Teachers of LA, UTLA, and the LA Unified School District to end a week-long strike. The deal commits to a reduction in class size, ensuring that every middle and high school has a librarian, and increasing teacher salaries by 6%. But just as the LA teacher strike resolved, teachers in Denver voted to go on strike for the first time in 25 years. Denver Public Schools has 5,600 educators. It's Colorado's largest district. The Denver Classroom Teachers Association represents two-thirds of that group. The strike will reportedly begin next week, though public school officials plan to keep schools open and staffed. That's just one story that caught our attention this week. Let's keep going with the Friday News Roundup with Katie Rogers of the New York Times, the BBC's Rajini Vaidyanathan, and Kimberly Adams of Marketplace. Kimberly, let's talk a little bit about the impact of this, because for families living paycheck to paycheck with less than 3 months' savings, this second missed check could completely blow up their budgets. You spent some time with the U.S. Conference of Mayors, which was meeting in D.C. this week.
Right. And mayors all over the country are so concerned about the shutdown. And they were here using the words pleading with federal legislators and leaders to come to some sort of resolution, because the point they were making is that it's your local communities that often have to provide the stopgap when these services run out. They're the ones having to float their local housing agencies when the Section 8 vouchers don't come through. They're the ones having to cover somebody's utility bills if, for example, they own the local utility. Here in D.C., we're hearing a lot of the direct effects of the shutdown. On the way in here this morning, I heard a local radio station having a food drive in a local parking lot for federal furloughed workers, people who maybe never imagined themselves going to a food bank, having to do so for the first time. It's really pinching a lot of people. And I know Katie was reporting on what seems to be a bit of a disconnect on this coming out of the White House.
Yeah, with regards to that disconnect, Katie, one of our listeners tweeted, "The shutdown won't end until it begins to affect the members of Congress. They should all be ashamed." Now, we heard those clips at the top of the show from Senator Cruz and Senator Bennett, who clearly had just kind of blown their stacks. But it seems like they had kind of blown their stacks at the other party, right, as opposed to at the situation.
Yeah. And I think that goes back to, I think, lawmakers, Republican and Democratic, they're not actually negotiating. They're talking past each other. And what's getting lost in this is 800,000 Americans who have gone a month without pay. And then at the very top, you have members of the administration castigating Democrats for not coming to the table, saying very little about federal workers who, you know, the average American does not have the kind of liquid assets or savings to cover a month of lost pay, let alone these work. I mean, it's just not feasible for most Americans, let alone any of these workers, to do that. So you're having lawmakers shouting at each other. Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, saying things like, why don't they just go take out a loan? And I just think that what, you know, the reporting I've done looks at federal workers who are frustrated with, you know, their voices not really being heard.
Rajini, you were in Kansas this week reporting on the shutdown. What did you see and what did you hear from people there?
I think the important thing that I learned from Kansas is two things. I'll start with the first one, which is the trickle-down effect of this shutdown. So I was in Wichita, Kansas, for one of the days that I was there. And I interviewed a woman who owns a cafe. It's called the Parsnippity Cafe, which is a great name. And it's in the tallest building in Wichita, in fact, the tallest building in Kansas, which is home to a lot of federal workers. So we're talking Secret Service, FBI. And her takings are about a third down. Now, she is not a federal worker. She's not furloughed, but she's seeing the effects. These people are not coming to work. They're not buying lunch. She's now had to reduce the hours of her staff, which is a huge issue for her. She is not able to work out what she's going to do with budgets. And the difference with someone like her, obviously the furloughed workers are going under a lot of pressure, but we know that they will get paid when this shutdown ends. Now, someone like this woman, Cynthia, she's not going to get that money back. And I think as this shutdown drags on, you know, past 30 days, that's the real concern that perhaps lawmakers are not seeing. It's the trickle-down effects. She just says, look, just reopen the government, then you can discuss what you need to.
With regard to those trickle-down effects, James is watching us on Facebook. James writes, I work at UPS, and we've seen a dramatic drop in package volume. This means instead of the usual 32 to 40 hours a week for part-time employees, we're barely making 20 hours. Mm. I am also starting my program at the University of Florida in the summer, and I'm afraid I will not be able to secure a loan because of the shutdown. Laura is also watching our video on Facebook. Laura writes, my son's elementary school is collecting gift cards for Coast Guard families so they can buy gas and groceries. Virginie?
Just one point I want to make, which is the counterpoint somewhat. And I was in a very small town called Greensburg in Kansas as well. And I was interviewing the former Republican mayor there for a different story, but I asked him afterwards what he thought about the shutdown. And he had a very different approach. He believes in small government. And he said, look, this is proof that we don't need so many government workers. If life can go on, things can function with 700,000, 800,000 federal workers not being employed, then look, this just proves we don't need that. I just thought it was an interesting perspective
life
on
goes
the
on
other
for
side.
Who? You know, it's sort of, that's an interesting take.
Well, and
it
is. And at what level? I mean, you know, one of the things that we've been hearing more about is the impact, obviously, on TSA and on air traffic control. Paul Rinaldi, who's the president of the Air Traffic Controllers Association, he spoke to Chris Cuomo on CNN on Wednesday about how dire, from his perspective, this situation really is.
When you look at our equipment is not being fixed.
Right.
I mean, equipment that we're relying on to make sure the airplanes line up on the right surface they're supposed to land on, as opposed to a taxiway or a different runway that's occupied by an airplane. This is critical equipment that has stopped being deployed and is not being fixed. Equipment like being able to relay to the pilot that the weather, dangerous weather is ahead. Radars have gone down. They're not being brought back up. That's how we get our weather information from those radar systems. This is a deep concern.
That's Paul Rinaldi, the president of the Air Traffic Controllers Association, speaking Wednesday on CNN. Lisa tweeted, I just booked a flight, but only give it a 50% chance of happening. Kimberly Adams, I hope she's wrong. I have to take a flight this afternoon after the show, but
I'm getting there
as soon as the show's over. But I do take her point. I mean, there are a lot of folks who have been suggesting, including some of our listeners, if the TSA went on strike for one day, this would be over. It seems like the air traffic controllers are under more scrutiny, not only from travelers who are super grateful that they show up for work, but also from citizens who are wondering if there may be the leverage that could end this.
I mean, perhaps it's hard to, watching this quote, air quotes, negotiation that we've seen in Washington, it's hard to see what is strong enough to break the impasse. If federal workers and contractors who won't get their money back at the end of this, if them having to line up for food is not enough to break an impasse, are angry, disgruntled travelers. Now, what that kind of brings to mind is something that we've seen is a real effort by this administration to blunt the impact of this shutdown on the broader American economy. You see them bringing back food inspectors, bringing back oil rig inspectors, and bringing back people to give farmers loans and IRS workers to process refunds. And so, there's this idea like, oh, we can get by without these federal workers. Well, we're not really getting by without them. We're not getting by without TSA workers and air traffic controllers and food inspectors. They're still doing it. They're just not getting paid.
Just as an aside, there are numerous lawsuits filed right now against the government on behalf of these people recalled back into work saying you're manipulating existing laws in order to classify people as accepted and bring us in. So this is, Air Traffic Controllers Union is actually one of these groups that has brought a suit saying, you can't be doing this. But also, like the point you're making here, it's not just disgruntled travelers. They're saying people may die. And they're saying you're playing with human safety right now. That's where the point we're at day 35.
There were two very strong interviews. If you missed Morning Edition today, I would go back and listen. One with a food inspector who says he's working a double shift. He's got colleagues who are working a double shift, basically not getting paid, but still covering the same amount of facilities. Another with an air traffic controller who said, essentially, if your job had a 99.9% success rate, you would be the best thing they'd ever seen. If we have a 99.9% success rate, that means that 50 planes crash every day. Regina?
I just briefly wanted to say the one thing that's really struck me, though, is just how much the American people have come together to help the people who have been affected by this. Just going back to the Parsnippity Cafe, loads of locals now have been going to the cafe just to kind of keep business going there. And we've seen, you know, not just John Bon Jovi, other local chefs,
Jose Andres, and
just generally other people donating, helping. So there is some kind of positive story in what is a really difficult and dark time.
There's more we want to get to, but we should look at the political path forward. Mystic Warrior tweets, is there any reason why yesterday's Senate couldn't have happened on December 23rd? Why was there no effort in December when the GOP controlled the Congress? Katie, what do we see as the next step in all this? Is there any, are there any benchmarks we should be looking for next week? Any signs of hope?
Yeah, I mean, the House Democrats are already looking at another proposal that would include a so-called smart wall, which means, you know, they would offer, we'll give you some money, but it won't be a physical barrier. We're going to have drones and technology. They're trying to find some way to reach, you know, to make something palatable enough that the president may, you know, agree to end this long enough to keep talking. So there is another effort on behalf of the Democrats to say, let's try to open the government. Let's find ways to fund border security. But like, let's do this while the government's running.
One other effect of the shutdown had to do with the State of the Union address. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi has twice rescinded President Trump's invitation to address the nation before a joint session of Congress. She cited security concerns for delaying the State of the Union until the shutdown ends, and this caused the president to do something he does not usually do. He relented. He agreed to wait until the government is reopened before giving the State of the Union address. Now, Kimberly, we should bear in mind, the Constitution requires the president to report from time to time on the State of the Union. It does not require him to do it in a live address before Congress. I think it was just like a written book report all the way up through Woodrow Wilson, basically. So there's not a constitutional issue here, but there's clearly a political issue. And I would fail to see how Nancy Pelosi doesn't take a little bit of satisfaction out of this.
Yeah, I mean, their power struggle between those two has really played out on a quite public stage in the recent weeks over the shutdown, how she's been able to keep the Democrats pretty much in line through these negotiations. And it's a shutdown has political costs for everyone. I mean, we've talked about the personal costs for all these affected workers, but there are political costs. These members of Congress are going back to their constituents who are demanding some kind of resolution, and Nancy Pelosi's been able to keep the Democrats pretty much in line. But, you know, it's interesting that Trump relented on delivering the State of the Union in the House of Representatives. He didn't necessarily have much of a choice because you can't really, as a president, go and give a speech in the State of the Union without the Speaker of the House giving the okay. And so his option was not, you know, to give the State of the Union or not. It was do it in the House or do it someplace else. And yeah, but the relenting, that was a surprise.
Yeah, and speaking of someplace else, last week I was talking to several, you know, senior officials about this back and forth letter writing that is, on one hand, it's the most passive-aggressive thing ever, and it's just like a catnip to people watching. But those officials were saying, well, we can do it wherever. And they referenced like the book report or, you know, we could give it on Mars if we want to. This was like one paraphrased response. And what was so interesting, yes, like was to see the president whose advisors have been thinking of ways he could do it, was to see him say, okay, yeah, I'll wait until this is, you know, in a better place. It was just,
technically he could. I mean, other than the fact that the State of the Union, the Speaker of the House kind of introduces the president every time, mm-hmm. ladies and gentlemen, here's the president, and then he speaks. Technically, he could go to the Kennedy Center. He could go anywhere, although I don't
know
if
he could do it at Mar-a-Lago.
He could do it at Mar-a-Lago, although I don't know if the workers at the Kennedy Center are on, because that's a national facility. Are they working? Is the Kennedy Center?
I believe the Kennedy Center is open.
Okay, so maybe they're open. But the point is, Regini, in part, he could have given the speech somewhere else if he wanted to, but the speech has a different political purpose. It's this opportunity for the president to create kind of his own narrative, to say the state of our union is strong. And unless you can say that in the House before the full Congress, it doesn't really read the same.
It's interesting because, as Katie was touching on, there were definitely conversations about whether or not the president would just get some big arena in Texas or somewhere in the Midwest where he's done rallies before and just say, I'm taking this to the people because Washington's dysfunctional, which is a message that certainly with his base would have gone down well. Now, they decided not to do that. I think partly as well, you know, it's not just members of Congress that go to the State of the Union. You have, you know, Supreme Court justices, you have real people who have their stories, you have dignitaries, you have celebrities. I mean, it is an event.
The Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Exactly. Yeah. Military. I mean, I was sitting in the chamber last year for the State of the Union, and you do see a different Donald Trump. You know, obviously he's president now, but I've seen him as president do rallies in the field. It's a very different type of president. But you know, it's important for him, I think, to show that he can be in that club too.
He likes the ceremony.
Like, yeah.
That is one thing we know about the president. He can be sort of a campaign firebrand when he wants to, but he also enjoys being presidential. He likes
the platform
coming up there and look, you know, and having
that
setting.
There's a ritual to all of that. It reminds me of the UK Parliament when we have the state opening. I mean, you know, he doesn't arrive in a carriage like the Queen does, but there is a lot of ritual the way he arrives in. And you know, it was great to watch it firsthand actually last year. I'd never seen it before.
For a president who wants a military parade, you can see why he would want the state.
And you know, he's
commander in
chief as well. Let us not forget. So
exactly.
You know, it's important for him, I think, to have stayed in that. But of course, you know, he will spin it one way, the Democrats will spin it another way. And it was ridiculous, I think, seeing these letters go back and forth.
Let's talk about Michael Cohen, President Trump's former lawyer and fixer. He was set to voluntarily testify on February 7th before the House Oversight and Reform Committee. It was an attempt to correct the record on lies he told Congress regarding President Trump's business interests in Moscow. This week, Cohen withdrew his decision to testify. His lawyer said the withdrawal was due to Cohen being on the receiving end of verbal attacks from the president. Katie Rogers, do we know anything more about the nature of these attacks, whether they came from the president or from intermediaries? Like, do we know just what Michael Cohen's talking about?
Yeah, we know exactly what Michael Cohen is talking about. The president has alluded to members of his family on shows like Fox News with Jeanine Pirro. She asked the president to name the father-in-law, essentially opening up what, you know, would be a doxing situation. The president declined in that setting. His own attorney, Rudy Giuliani, has alluded to Michael Cohen's father-in-law. And I think the latest, I think, as of last night, is that Cohen was again subpoenaed. His lawyer said that he will now comply and come forth. And now Michael Cohen's lawyer is accusing Rudy Giuliani of witness tampering. So it's a very fraught situation involving father-in-law's accusations flying around about his family. He's going to go forth and talk to Congress.
More I wanted to mention about Rudy Giuliani in a minute, but Rajini, Michael Cohen also has a subpoena from the Senate Intelligence Committee, which leaves him no option, we would think, but to comply and testify next month. I wonder, once that hearing happens, what that might look like compared to what we expected from the House. Will it be open? Will it be behind closed doors? Are the expectations the same? How might they stack up?
That I'm not sure of, but what we do know is that Michael Cohen is due to start a prison sentence next month, March. Is that right?
March, yeah. So
the clock is ticking. And as this back and forth goes, I mean, yes, they've agreed to comply. They've agreed that he will testify. But we had a date in the diary of February the 7th and then, you know, just over a week to go and it's not going to happen. There could be some really explosive things that come out of this. We've all read the indictments in terms of Michael Cohen admitting that he lied to Congress relating to two things, campaign finance violations, those payments he made, he says, directed by the president to Stormy Daniels and another woman. And also the issues around the Moscow project, the plan to build a Trump Tower in Moscow. Again, that was back in the headlines over how much the president and his family knew during the heat of the campaign. So I think, you know, there's a lot for Rudy Giuliani and President Trump to fear about this testimony happening. So as you say, it could be that they will argue it should be closed doors. Of course, the plan for next week was that it was going to be public. I think I'm right in saying.
But Kimberly, you know, Michael Cohen has been denounced by the president, among others, for being a liar And that's one of those, you know, questions that some of the president's supporters have brought up. Why would we trust what he will say now, considering he was okay with lying once?
Yeah, it's funny. When you say that you're a liar, people tend to not believe what you say, which can be problematic when you're trying to cooperate with an investigation that hinges so much on who knew what when and how much, you know, in what exact circumstances you lied. So, yes, that does make it problematic for Michael Cohen, and also gives fresh ammunition to Trump supporters. And, you know, when he's talking about the threats against his family, I think it's important to talk about the moment that we're in, particularly as it pertains to social media. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just what the president says. It's what the president's words might encourage other people to do. We saw a lot of this during the presidential campaign in terms of how people behaved at rallies. It's in addition to the Pizzagate right. scandal and other things.
This is the point about doxing, when you have the president being asked on Fox News to name the father-in-law he's accusing of being tied to organized crime.
And by doxing, you mean when people get someone's name and then reveal all their personal details right. yes. online to make them a target. Yeah.
Can we talk about Rudy Giuliani for a minute, who's now acting as President Trump's personal lawyer? He spent part of the week backtracking from comments he made this past Sunday on Meet the Press. He contradicted the president's public recollection about involvement in building a skyscraper in Moscow. Now, Katie Rogers, I was on Meet the Press that day. Hmm. I remember before the show, the folks from Meet the Press came back and they were like, okay, so we just talked to Rudy Giuliani, and here's what he said. And I remember Chuck Todd asked him like three times to confirm his recollection uh-huh. that the conversations about Trump Tower did not just go as far as January or June of 2016, but might have gone up to October or November of 2016, right up to the election. And then Rudy Giuliani walked that back after he said it and confirmed it on Meet the Press in the same interview. What are the implications of this walk back, potentially?
I mean, I think that you have to look at who Giuliani is and his role as sort of creating confusion. He was brought on to be an aggressive defender of the president, to send, just flood the zone. This is more flooding the zone with mixed signals. He might have been trying to make a nuanced point about, yeah, we could have been talking about this, at which point he, you know, we invoke executive privilege. Like, I think that's what he's getting at with, this is all hypothetical. Like, this could have happened. I think he's trying to speak multiple different languages of the Mueller investigation and not particularly doing it very well. But that's sort of what he's brought there to do. He's there to defend the president. And regardless of whether or not he's walking back, walking forward, he has been successful in, like, going back to Cohen, he's been successful in pushing a message forward. I don't mean to say it doesn't matter, but this is part of the strategy. It's just
yeah, he's
more...
he's a lawyer for the TV age. He is the reality yes. TV lawyer in a way. And so it doesn't really matter. I mean, people will question, why does President Trump keep someone like this who is walking back things? But it's about, you know, the impact he has on shows like Fox and Friends. Mm-hmm. He has a huge following. I remember during the 2016 campaign, he was often the warm-up act at these rallies. He has a huge following with the base. And so, you know, he fits in with the message and he's blindly loyal to the president.
It's hard to know if what he did that with this is strategy. Like, he's part of a bigger strategy. But the question I think a lot of us reporters have about him is this a practiced sort of thing he's doing in terms of, like, fudging the timeline and right. walking back? Or, like, is this just...
But listen, we live in Washington, D.C., a city of lawyers. Most lawyers we meet, with the greatest respect, aren't the best communicators.
Yeah.
Rudy Giuliani can get his message across, whether or not it's correct at times.
Let's talk politics and an expected announcement, a somewhat expected announcement that came on Martin Luther King Jr. Day.
I am running for president of the United States.
Well, and
and I'm very excited about it.
That was Democratic Senator Kamala Harris of California announcing her official run for president in 2020. It happened on Monday on ABC's Good Morning America. This makes four Democratic women now exploring or officially declared as running: Harris, Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, and Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii. Kimberly, what are some of the early discussions around Kamala Harris's bid for president, other than the fact that this came as a surprise to absolutely nobody?
She has a network that I think is really going to be an important one heading into this particular Democratic primary, and that is Black Democratic women, who are some of the most reliable organizers, voters in the Democratic Party. And she's going to be tapping into her sorority connections. She's a member of Alpha Kappa Alpha, which is an African-American sorority that has a huge network. She is going to be tapping into, you know, some of these other Black women who we've really saw, especially in the midterms, rising up and organizing a lot. That said, it's a very crowded field with a lot of very similar stances on issues. And so will that be enough, in addition to her record in criminal justice as a prosecutor? Will that be enough to kind of make her stand out?
Well, it's actually early. Isn't she sort of another problem, I think, is the fracturing in the Democratic Party, as in the more like liberal wing of that party, sort of, you know, her tough on crime stance as a prosecutor is not necessarily an asset. So she'll have to overcome that in addition to standing out because of it.
Because she was the district attorney in San Francisco and also California's attorney general before she became the senator who succeeded Barbara Boxer. Another name, Katie Rogers, that has of a candidate that has now launched an exploratory committee is a little challenging to pronounce, but I've practiced. Pete Buttigieg. He's the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. What do we know about the guy that we call Mayor Pete?
Well, I don't know if you know this, but I'm from the town next door to Mayor Pete's town. I'm from Elkhart, Indiana. So I know Mayor Pete. I call him Mayor Pete because I can't pronounce the last name. He ran for DNC chair. He is well-liked. He's got a good story. He's a veteran. He's gay. He is kind of a up-and-coming, fix the potholes, but also I'm looking at the rest of the field kind of politician. He's got a lot of charisma. I don't know that, again, the field is very crowded, and I think that he's going to have a rough road continuing in a increasingly crowded field of, like, big personalities.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Let's talk about the Supreme Court in the minutes we have left. This week, justices upheld the Trump administration's ban on transgender recruits. The policy states that transgender people cannot serve in the military and people must serve under the biological sex they were assigned at birth. Rajini, it's worth noting that this is not the end of the argument. There are still lower court cases, if I recall correctly. So this still remains somewhat of an open legal question.
Yeah, I don't know too much about the details of where the legal challenges are. But the one thing that struck me is I just remember how this all first came about. It was a presidential tweet, I recall. And I remember at the time in Washington, you know, there were officials kind of wondering whether they'd actually planned for this planned change to reverse what was brought in under the Obama administration. And I was just talking to Kimberly, actually, before we came on air. It just reminded me of being at one of the inaugural balls, the military ball, where President Trump and Melania Trump, First Lady, arrived. And obviously, there were lots of members of the military as guests. And I was struck that day. I interviewed a number of transgender serving members of the military who were decorated. And it struck me on that day when President Trump took office, how much had changed in terms of the way the military in the United States looks. But of course, this plan from the president, which of course is being challenged, is a complete reversal of that. And it just reminds us of a lot of the rollbacks that he's brought in.
One more story that we wanted to get to, and I wanted to leave a little time because we've gotten a lot of reaction on this story, not surprisingly, including from probably some folks in New Orleans. When it comes to football, New Orleanians go hard for the home team, which is why fans of the New Orleans Saints were furious about Sunday's championship game against the Los Angeles Rams. Here is what some Saints fans had to say after that game to WWL-TV in New Orleans.
I think it's going to go down as the worst non-call in history.
In the wide open field, passing the field.
Oh, Lord, the
and
ref,
they did not throw a flag. They
the
took
ref,
it from us. They robbed us
the
of
ref.
It.
I can't say what I want to say, but Lord Jesus, they took it away from us.
Yeah.
It was bad. It hurts, you know, to come here and see that.
The only thing I can say is I'm going to pray for those referees, okay? Thank you.
So here's what happened. Essentially, the referees failed to call a pass interference penalty on Rams cornerback Nickell Roby-Coleman. He hit a Saints receiver helmet to helmet, which is a big no-no. But no one called him on it. and the game went on, despite the Saints head coach Sean Payton fuming from the sidelines, and a lot of fans too. That allowed the Rams to win in overtime. New Orleans fans are expressing their outrage in creative ways. One local bakery is selling cookies with a red X across the referee's face. Another fan bought out billboards in and around Atlanta, where the Super Bowl will take place. Some season ticket holders are suing the NFL. Even Louisiana's governor issued a formal complaint. Here are some of the comments you shared with us. Mike tweeted, "It was the worst blown call in history, period. Only question would be, what were the momentary Vegas odds on the game-winning team right before and right after?" Goodell, Roger Goodell, the commissioner of the NFL, had the right to replay the game from that point. He didn't. Life sucks and then you die. Carla wrote to Saints fans, "Get over it. We all have missed or bad calls that have derailed our team's successes. For example, Vikings fans resented our 2009 NFC Championship loss to the Saints when Saints players earned bounties for injuring our quarterback. Karma is a B." And John Paul wrote on our Facebook page, "The Rams, the Patriots, and Maroon 5. Do I need any more reasons not to watch the Super Bowl?
This is the most 2009. This is like the perfect Super Bowl for this year, isn't it? Everybody's mad. Like, nobody's happy. Kansas City's mad. They lost to the Patriots. The Patriots are like, yeah, we're not going anywhere. You know, the Rams fans are like, cool. Saints fans are mad. Like, are the Rams fans the only happy people?
Oh, no. Well, then there's those of us who are just bitter because I'm from St. Louis.
Yeah.
And the Rams did us so dirty.
Moved from St. Louis to Los Angeles, and now they're going to the Super Bowl.
This is perfect. Because greed. Everybody should just. It's like the Festivus of Super Bowls. It's like the Super Bowl of grievances.
So what I don't get, though, is, you know, having covered the soccer, as you call it, World Cup, I don't work for FIFA, but FIFA and the football organizations brought in video assistant referees so they could actually watch calls back and make decisions. Now, from what I understand, you were saying, Joshua, the NFL doesn't have
They do have video replay, but not like can we bring you back for the hour when we talk about reforming the NFL? Virginia Vaidyanathan of the BBC, Katie Rogers of the New York Times, and Kimberly Adams of Marketplace, thank you all for being with us. We leave you with the song "I'll Fight" by Jennifer Hudson from the soundtrack to RBG, the documentary whose song was nominated for the Academy Award for Best Original Song. We'll dive into the international section of the Friday News Roundup in just a moment. So
support for this podcast and the following message come from Hinge. Hinge is the dating app that's designed to be deleted. It's for people who want to get off dating apps. Show off your personality with icebreaker prompts and see who likes you so you can easily start a conversation. On Hinge, 3 out of 4 first dates lead to second dates, and they're the number one dating app mentioned in the New York Times wedding section. Download Hinge in the Apple Store or Google Play.
Hi, this is Peter Sagal. For 20 years, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me has been making fun of the news with comedians and celebrity guests. We got silly limericks. We got terrible impressions. If you think the news is a joke, wait till you hear our show. New podcast episodes are available every Saturday.
The world has been a very busy place these past 7 days. The uber-rich and powerful gathered again in Davos, but this year's meeting is standing out for those who are not there. A government crackdown in Zimbabwe has many concerned that country is slipping backwards. And who is in charge of Venezuela? Really? President Nicolas Maduro is under pressure to resign. His opponent, backed by the United States, has now declared himself president, but Russia has doubled down on its support for Maduro. Here to help us round up this week's top international stories are Nina Maria Potts, Director of Global News Coverage for Feature Story News. Nina Maria, welcome back to the Roundup.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Susan Glasser, a staff writer at The New Yorker. Susan, welcome.
Thanks so much.
And James Kitfield, Senior Fellow at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress and the author of Twilight Warriors, the Soldiers, Spies, and Special Agents Who Are Revolutionizing the American Way of War. James, glad to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Let us begin in Venezuela. In front of thousands of supporters in the streets of Caracas on Wednesday, opposition leader Juan Guaido proclaimed himself the interim president.
Culo. Asumir formalmente las competencias del Ejecutivo Nacional como el presidente encargado de Venezuela.
He said, I swear to assume all the powers of the national executive as the interim president of Venezuela. Guaido said he was taking power to end what he described as a treasonous government and have free elections. President Nicolas Maduro has been in charge of the country for years. He is clearly not happy about this challenge to his power, but many Western governments have moved quickly to endorse his rival. Nina Maria Potts, let me start with you. Who is Juan Guaido?
Well, I mean, to some extent, he's really taken the world by surprise. And it's worth saying that he's taken even people in Venezuela by surprise. We have had a bureau in Venezuela for the past 3 years, and we have been covering very closely the rise and fall and falling apart of the opposition. And it looked as if the opposition had really broken apart and splintered and was not going anywhere after quite intense protests 18 months ago and a year ago. We covered Maduro's re-election, and I have to say that the atmosphere was almost apathetic and really, I think he came out of nowhere. It's a technicality, but he did take power on January the 5th as the leader of the National Assembly, really by accident, because it was part of a power-sharing deal. He comes from the Caribbean state in Venezuela. He stepped into center stage somewhat by surprise. He's been very effective at meeting the rural poor. He's been out on the road for town hall meetings. There's an information blackout on his name. So people in outside Caracas, who rely heavily on national television, government-controlled national television, have really not seen his face, nor really known about him in any great depth or detail. So he has taken Venezuela and the international community by surprise.
James Kitfield, how did we get to this point? Was there one kind of pivotal moment that made Juan Guaido such a big figure, or that kind of propelled him to where he is now?
I think the pivotal moment was last summer's election, which the whole world, and we talked about it on the show at the time, it was baldly a fraudulent election that was stolen by Maduro. Since then, I think a lot of the Organization of American States leaders, as well as the United States, have been thinking about how can we find some way to get Maduro gone. And I think the hope was that at some point, and I think this is the hope behind this gambit here, is that the military will basically abandon Maduro. And so far that has not happened. But as these protests get more deadly, and they've already, you know, led to deaths of a number of protesters, the hope is that this guy is someplace else where the military should shift its allegiance to, in a way that would be at least an orderly transition. I think that is the hope in this gambit, but it's a risky gambit because we've basically declared our support for a shadow government, refused to withdraw our people, our diplomatic people, out of Venezuela, even though Maduro has insisted on that and is removing his own people from the United States. So it's a risky gamble, but I will say one thing. Trump is not known for his multilateral instincts. He's got the Organization of American States behind him and much of the free world behind him on this.
I just want to make sure we emphasize the point that you just made for people who have not been following the timeline. The election was when?
Last July, I believe.
And now it's January.
Right.
So this has been dragging on for quite a long time. But with regards to what you said about the president's role, Susan, Steve writes, I thought we were going to be a nationalist country. What does Trump care about South America? Interesting point, because Vice President Mike Pence posted a video on Twitter this week with regards to what's happening in Venezuela.
Nicolas Maduro is a dictator with no legitimate claim to power. He's never won the presidency in a free and fair election.
So that's what Mike Pence posted on Twitter this week. I'd like to get your sense on what impact it has that the U.S. has taken a side in this at all and what that might mean. Rachel writes, weren't similar pledges made to Shiites in Iraq, Kurds in Syria, South Vietnamese, Native Americans? What does the support of the U.S. count for in this situation?
Well, look, all foreign policy is situational. And in this situation, even if not everywhere else in the world, the Trump administration is actually, you know, very consistent with the previous rhetoric of the Republican Party, in particular, conservatives inside the Republican Party who've long made this a cause célèbre for two decades, basically. We've had first Hugo Chavez, and since he died, his successor and
mentee, if you will, Nicolas Maduro in office. And Chavismo has been set up as sort of the bête noire of the American right, or a segment of it. And so it's a cause that's close to the heart not only of Mike Pence. You have John Bolton, national security advisor, who's also a longtime hawk because of the nexus between Cuba and Venezuela. And then you have another interesting factor here, which I wrote about this week in The New Yorker, Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, who, although he was Trump's rival and critic, especially on foreign policy, has had wide latitude and tons of influence over the administration's policy toward Latin America, and in particular toward Venezuela. And Rubio has very smartly, it seems to me, over the last couple of years, kind of played on Trump's desire to personalize issues. He brought in the very articulate wife of the imprisoned opposition leader, Leonardo Lopez, at the very beginning of the Trump administration. We've all forgotten it, but back in August of 2017, the same day that Donald Trump said he was going to rain down fire and fury on North Korea if they didn't do what he wanted, he also talked unasked about a military option in Venezuela. So this is not from nowhere. This is actually an issue where the administration has sort of had a kind of an obsession all along. But it is, of course, an incredible departure from an outlier towards the administration's approach to autocrats and dictators right around the world. Chris Murphy from Connecticut tweeted the other day, strongmen are befuddled by this incident.
That strongman aspect, Nina Maria, also plays into this larger narrative. It's obvious why Senator Marco Rubio, whose parents were Cuban exiles, who is very staunchly against strongman governments and had a lot to say about Hugo Chavez when he was the leader of Venezuela, of course, as an ally to Fidel Castro. That makes sense. I wonder if that also factors in a larger sense with Russia being aligned with Venezuela, because Vladimir Putin and Nicolas Maduro are buddies, and Maduro said in the last few days he had a phone call with Vladimir Putin, and Putin said, we're still behind you all the way.
Well, Maduro is clinging on, I think, to that support from President Putin. He's also had support, I think, Recep Tayyip Erdogan was among the first to give him a call to express his support. And Spain, interestingly, is holding out because Iglesias is of the far left and has also been deeply supportive of the revolution. And I think he has said that he wants to wait to see what the European Union's united position on Venezuela will be before he speaks out. So Venezuela's clinging on to a lot. But I wanted to bring it back a little bit to real world perspectives. From our point of view, you know, we have a team of four journalists on the ground. I speak to them every day. Last night, you know, they told me that they have running water in their apartment blocks for 30 minutes a day. So if they miss that window at 8 p.m., they can't wash or wash their clothes. The electricity goes out.
Wait. Running water for 30 minutes for the whole day?
Yeah. So, you know, if we're doing live shots and reporting from our bureau and they get home late, they've missed that window. The electricity goes out sort of after dark. My producer, she lives on the 11th floor. She has to climb 11 flights of stairs to get to her apartment in the dark. Groceries, the grocery basket, the shopping basket is now something like $900 a month. And if you think that the minimum wage is $6.50 in Venezuela, to buy an ice cream these days, it costs $40. The situation has declined. We've talked about gradual decline. This situation has been rapid.
Susan?
Well, I'm so glad that you brought that up. I have to say, one of the most powerful interviews I ever did with my former beloved deceased podcast at Global Politico was about Venezuela, from a young AP reporter who came there, coming out of the United States, where we have a very overly partisan and politicized view, unfortunately, of the situation in Venezuela. It's become, this is sort of the right-wing cause celeb. There are left-wing human rights crises that we pay more attention to. It doesn't reflect the reality on the ground. And this young woman who came with a very American perspective, lived there in Venezuela, watched the deterioration. She said, when my friends, my middle-class university-educated friends, started losing weight because they didn't have enough to eat, there was a bread line outside her house for the bakery's garbage. There was no bread in the bakery. They were actually queuing for the garbage.
With regards to the election itself, Cecilia tweeted, Maduro overrode Venezuela's constitution by calling for illegal elections. He became a usurper on January 10th. Guaido is assuming the presidency to uphold the rule of law. Contrast that with what AC tweeted. AC writes, This is outrageous. Imagine if tomorrow Hillary Clinton declared herself the legitimate president of America. Now imagine that our allies and other Americans backed her proclamation. Can you imagine the violence and mayhem that would ensue? Maduro is the elected president. James Kitfield, I see AC's point. There's a logical flaw in that the presidential election is not a popular vote, it's an electoral vote. So, by the electoral count, Donald Trump did win the presidency, barring some other malfeasance. But I see what he's getting at. This idea that anybody will tell another country, oh, no, 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 no. Your elections are so screwed up. Well, we're just going to tell you who your president is.
Right. So by every international observer, that election was fraudulent and he is a usurper. But it does raise the question, is it our responsibility to ensure, you know, smooth democratic governance all around the world? No, it is not. And I think that if it wasn't for what my colleagues here have pointed out, that Venezuela is a failed state in the heart of Latin America. It is causing destabilization around the country. It's a narco state. It's supported by drug cartels. It is as bad as it gets, and the exodus of people from Venezuela is causing instability throughout the region. So this is not something that the U.S. regime created. This is a problem that Maduro and before him Chavez created. And I think that the problem for the Trump administration was bad outcomes were going to happen if you did nothing, and bad outcomes could happen if you do something. So they have taken a firm step in recognizing this shadow government. Now this could go two ways, and one way is could be positive, which is that the Venezuelan military eventually sees the writing on the wall and basically changes its allegiance, and that would be a very positive outcome. And this new guy has said, I will hold elections. I will give I will not try to arrest Maduro. He can leave the country. But this could also turn out like Syria. If you remember, President Obama said Assad must go. You know, he was a murderous dictator.
Right.
And his military stuck with him, and we've now had more than 500,000 deaths there, and it's a failed state. And it brought in a lot of other actors, too, and that's destabilized that whole region. So this is extremely serious crisis, and we're kind of at the razor's edge.
Before we move on from Venezuela, there are two other factors that I think we need to talk about, which is oil, because Venezuela has a lot of oil under the ground, and the military. Two of you commented on the military in particular, two among several. Danielle wrote, if they can't sell their oil, Maduro will be finished. An army doesn't stay loyal unless you pay them. George is listening from McLean, Virginia, not far from D.C. George writes, the Venezuelan government is alleged to be heavily involved in narco trafficking, with the top ranks of the military all being involved. Is it rational to hope that the military will ever abandon Maduro? I'd like to ask Susan about the role of the military and Nina Maria about the potential for amnesty for those members of the military before we move on to talking about other things. But Susan, how do you see the military factoring into all of this?
Well, I think it's important to point out that it is essentially like a narco state in the sense that with so many people implied and implicated in the regime's corruption and crimes, it's very hard to get them to voluntarily give up power in a scenario like that. And so I think you see the question of whether the top people are very, very unlikely, therefore, to abandon ship because they're the ones who are most at risk if their system of corruption topples. The question is whether there are enough rank and file soldiers and people who, again, who aren't getting paychecks, who are living in this deteriorating country, that they simply refuse to follow orders or en masse break. That remains much more of a possibility. You mentioned Venezuela's oil economy. It has one of the largest oil reserves in the world. However, because of the deteriorating, crumbling state of the economy, I read the other day that they are down to 500,000 barrels a day of exports to the United States, half of what they were exporting just a few years ago. And I can't state enough. This is not an ideological point at this point, fight at this point, 20 years into Chavismo and its failed experiment. They have taken what was looking to be a modern industrialized country and society in the heart of Latin America, and they are forcing these people back to the Stone Ages.
And to that point, they've also kind of scared away other companies from other parts of the world that would love to come in and do more with refining Venezuela's oil, with building up that whole sector, but Venezuela is just so unstable that they kind of can't do business. With regards to the future, Nina Maria Jules writes, unfortunately, the best solution for this is probably to give Maduro a golden parachute. One wants to see these SOBs pay for their atrocities, but not at the cost of deadly civil unrest. That seems seems to be part of the idea behind Guaido offering amnesty for some in Maduro's circle.
Well, Guaido has reiterated his offer of amnesty, and it raises a very interesting question, this get-out-of-jail-free card, essentially, that he's offering to Maduro. But I think it's, you know, we can't overstate how afraid people are and afraid to believe that that might even be a possibility. And in fact, talking to people on the ground in Venezuela, you know, the comeback is Maduro is deeply embedded and part of the revolution. He would rather fight to the end than go to jail and be held account for corruption and successive generations of corruption. So I think that is a factor in terms of propelling the opposition. We're seeing television images of people out in the street, but a lot of people are staying home afraid. They're not taking their kids to school. They don't want to step out of their door. They can't get to work. There are no cars and buses. You know, so I think that there is a level of distrust and mistrust and a sense that despite the excitement around international pressure building on Venezuela, the people on the ground still can't quite believe it.
Let's make our way to Davos, Switzerland, where thousands of political and business leaders are there for the World Economic Forum. This year, that list of leaders did not include President Trump or anyone from the administration attending in person. The president canceled the group's plans last week, citing the government shutdown. But he was not the only world leader to bail. Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May also skipped the event, as did France's President Emmanuel Macron, Russian President Vladimir Putin, and China's President Xi Jinping. Now, on Wednesday, Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel delivered her keynote address. Here's a clip of it, and you'll be hearing it through an interpreter.
There is a new approach that we see in the world today, an approach that harbors great doubts as to the validity of the international system. They say, shouldn't we look after our own? Shouldn't we look after our own interests first? And then, out of that, develop an order that is good for all. I have my grave doubts that this is the right way to go about it. I think our national interests, well, we should understand them in such a way that we always remember that others also have their own vested interests, factor them in, and then shape a win-win situation that will guide us in international politics.
That's Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel speaking this year at the World Economic Forum in Davos. James Kitfield, is that the attitude of most of the leaders who did attend Davos this year, kind of reflected in what Chancellor Merkel had to say?
Well, I think she was spot on. I mean, and what's kind of, well, what's is very worrisome is that Angela Merkel, who's basically almost a lame duck, has admitted she's not going to run again for leader, is the voice of the Western democracies who's arguing for a rules-based international order and globalization. And at the same time she's doing that, all these other countries, including our own, are stuck into these crises that have at their root this nationalist populism we saw. I mean, in our own country, President Trump, first president ever to force himself engineer a shutdown, which is why it's the longest in history. He's in charge of the executive branch, and he is, because of his wall, has decided to shut down our own government. Theresa May is facing a hard Brexit that could plunge the United Kingdom and the European Union into an absolutely disastrous breakup. And Macron from France is facing these street protests that have forced him to sort of go back on a lot of his pledges trying to get his economy in order. So I was on a trip with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs to Europe last fall, and you very much sense that the Western democracies are on their heels and rocking, and this is just another sign of it. It is amazing that so many Western leaders have decided they couldn't take time out from their crises to attend Davos.
Yeah. Susan, what is the deal with so many leaders not attending Davos? Is it because they're busy dealing with domestic dramas? You know, Davos has come under a lot of criticism for being, in the eyes of some people, kind of everything that's wrong with the global economy, the super-duper uber-rich getting together on a Swiss mountaintop to determine what happens in the economies that deal with 7 billion people.
Well, you're right. The politics and certainly the optics of it aren't good. I've actually attended Davos, I think, 6 or 7 times as a journalist. And, you know, what I observed is that it is fundamentally a business gathering. And if you are the CEO of a company, a global company, it's an extremely efficient way to have a lot of meetings with a lot of people. And these political figures are sort of the window dressing attracted often, by the way, I must say, by a very cynical Swiss attitude of accepting hordes of funding from whatever dictatorships and, you know, up and coming Central Asian countries, you know, are looking to make a mark. 1 year, all the buses are sold out with ads from Kazakhstan. The next year, it's Malaysia that's buying all the sponsorships. The Russian oligarchs, including many who now figure in our domestic politics, famous for throwing over-the-top parties at Davos. So it's not necessarily, in fact, it's a terrible political message to send if you're a struggling Western leader. However, the flip side is, I think, reflected in Angela Merkel's very earnest address the other day, her defense of the global order. I just spent the last few months actually working on a very interesting for me article about Angela Merkel as sort of the failed leader of the free world in the wake of President Trump's election. That was what a lot of people said, you know, semi-tongue-in-cheek after Trump was elected. Well, now Merkel is the person who's going to have to represent the world order. I think that's
the grown-up in the room, so
that's correct. And that speech reflects both her desire to be one and her inability to be so. Germany is simply not, as it's constituted in its post-war, post-Cold War era, it is a fundamentally multilateral country. It is not a country that can on its own exert that kind of global leadership. The system depends upon America leading. When America is absent, we haven't figured out what to do about it.
So Nina Maria, let's contrast what we heard from Angela Merkel a second ago with what we heard from Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Now, as we said, the U.S. delegation did not attend in person, but Secretary Pompeo did deliver a speech via Skype. Here's part of what he said.
In Ohio, Rio de Janeiro, and in Rome, people are asking questions that haven't been asked or at least haven't been taken seriously in an awfully long time. Is economic globalization really good for me? Are political leaders adequately protecting us from threats like terrorism? Are they working to secure our national interests abroad? You all know this. New winds are blowing across the world. The central question is this: do they signal fair weather or foreshadow a storm? Is this pattern of disruption a force for good or not? I'd argue that this disruption is a positive development.
That's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo speaking via Skype to the World Economic Forum in Davos. Nina Maria, it's a very different tone than Chancellor Merkel.
Well, to Susan's point about the optics, the fact that Mike Pompeo Skyped in, I think from my point of view, why can't everybody just Skype in? I mean, it's an enormously expensive event.
Because then you're not in Switzerland on a mountaintop.
No, and I'll tell you that as a news
director. If I could do the show from a mountaintop in Switzerland.
Course, but it would cost me as a news director €2,500 a night to have a team there. And at that point this year, we just said this time, no, Davos is no longer as relevant as it was. The catchphrase this year at Davos was inclusive capitalism, which, you know, bringing Mike Pompeo, coming back to Mike Pompeo, I think, you know, Davos this year was about redefining what globalization means. And of course, the irony of Trump, President Trump, his speech last year, which really ruffled feathers when he put his America First agenda so loudly on the table, is that that viewpoint has gone mainstream. And again, I think my fellow guests here have already said that, you know, it's a very different atmosphere, and they are, I think, scrambling to redefine a message that will be listened to and heard by mainstream voting electorates. Yeah.
Well, let's come down off the mountaintop at Switzerland and shift gears from the super wealthy in Davos to Zimbabwe, where violence broke out this week after the nation's president doubled the price of gasoline. According to NPR News, it is now the most expensive place to get gasoline in the world. There have been protests throughout the country. The government has cracked down on demonstrators, and James Kitfield, brutal beatings are nothing new, unfortunately, when it comes to Zimbabwe and its forces. This seems like the kind of thing that folks had hoped would not befall Zimbabwe after 37 years of Robert Mugabe being in charge, succeeded by Emmerson Mnangagwa, the current president. How is this happening? Is this something that Mnangagwa is responsible for? Is this the lingering effect of Robert Mugabe? What's going on in Zimbabwe?
Well, you know, unfortunately, I think everyone hoped that after Mugabe had left the scene that there would be a dramatic change. But this guy was his hatchet man, this guy. You know, he wears this scarf with the colors of the country, and everyone thought he's kind of rebranding to a softer, gentler sort of leadership in Zimbabwe. But we're discovering that he has the same authoritarian and rather iron-fisted tendencies of Mugabe. I think I can't with the number of casualties of people who have died, I think, is up to 12 or 14 already. They're using live ammunition against protesters. I mean, this is very reminiscent of Mugabe, and it just, you know, it's dashing a lot of hopes.
Susan?
You know, I'm not an expert on Zimbabwe at all, but when the new leader's name is the crocodile, perhaps you shouldn't be overly optimistic about the kind of flowering of democracy and reform.
Yeah, the latest word from the Washington Post, just from a quick search, is at least 12 are dead in this crackdown, killed by security forces in Zimbabwe. There's a little more I'd like to talk about with regards to Zimbabwe when we continue the Friday News Roundup. We also want to talk about what's been going on with China, the latest in the saga over the tech company Huawei and its chief financial officer. As we pause, we should also note the death of a popular Afro-jazz musician from Zimbabwe named Oliver Tukuzi. His fans call him Tuku. Here's a taste of a little bit of his music. This track is called Neria, from the late Afro-jazz musician Oliver Tukuzi. We'll get to more of the world's top stories and some of your questions and comments just ahead. Stay close.
This message comes from NPR sponsor REI. REI believes that a life outdoors is a life well lived, and they have for 80 years. So check out their podcast, Wild Ideas Worth Living, for inspiring stories of people who took the road less traveled. Hear from explorers, athletes, authors, and experts in the field. Follow how they're taking wild ideas and making them a reality every day. Find it on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
While you're sleeping, the team that produces the Up First podcast is, well, up first, making sure you get the freshest take on the day's news. It's a 10-minute morning news podcast from NPR, and you can hear Up First on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Back now to the Friday News Roundup with Nina Maria Potts of Feature Story News, Susan Glasser of The New Yorker, and James Kitfield of the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. Let's talk a little bit more about Zimbabwe before we move on and what might be next for them, Nina Maria, particularly because the Human Rights Commission has called the violence we're seeing in Zimbabwe, in its words, systemic torture. What does this look like for Zimbabwe's future?
Well, I think what's tragic and disappointing about the new president of Zimbabwe is that he had just finished an international trip and actually came back from Davos, or saying he was not going to Davos in order to deal with the situation back home. And what's particularly disappointing was that he was disingenuous when it became clear that there'd been this internet shutdown and an information blackout. He came back with a lie, essentially, which was that the internet traffic was so heavy that there had been a slowdown, rather than tackling the issue that the internet had been shut down by the government. In terms of the systemic human rights abuses, there are reports on the ground that the security forces have broken into private homes, that they've been torturing citizens, traumatizing children. This is in the last weeks. And you know, he was abroad basically to make a pitch to investors for Zimbabwe and to raise money and funds. And there was a degree of optimism, and I think that it's just staggeringly disappointing to come back to this, as my fellow guests have said, a legacy of Mugabe that clearly is here to stay.
Let's shift gears to an update in the story of a Chinese business executive named Meng Wanzhou. Meng Wanzhou is the chief financial officer of a telecom company called Huawei, which has been in the news recently. She was arrested in early December for charges related to violating American sanctions on Iran. Since Meng's arrest, the story has grown to be about much more than the criminal charges against her. This week, according to the New York Times, the U.S. will ask Canada, where Meng is being held, to extradite her to the U.S. to stand trial. Now, there was a news conference on Tuesday where Canada's ambassador to China, John McCallum, spoke to reporters. McCallum said he thinks Meng has a strong shot at avoiding extradition to the U.S., where she would stand trial.
I think she has some strong arguments
that she can make before a judge, and then the judge will decide whether he or she thinks that she should be extradited or not.
That was John McCallum, Canada's ambassador to China. Susan Glasser, why does this extradition request make a difference? It's fairly significant when you get down to it.
Well, and by the way, there's an important postscript to that news conference, which tells you about the significance of the case, which is that Canada has just forced the envoy and has itself disavowed that statement and said that it was an inappropriate meddling on the part of the ambassador in their judicial process.
Oh.
There's a reason why. The ambassador went on in that news conference to cite President Trump's comments, which appear to bias the case and other matters, and it really casts Canada's decision in a highly political light, as if it was potentially bowing to the will of its neighbor rather than engaging in a neutral political process. So it's a highly charged case. And of course, sanctioning Iran has been at the centerpiece of the Trump administration's international diplomacy since it decided to unilaterally withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal. What better way, in a way, to also converge it with the administration's other foreign policy priority, which, of course, is pushing China on its trade deal, and also the extent to which Chinese state-owned companies or state companies are acting as agents of China and pose a national security threat to the U.S. and other interests. So it's a really, it's a geopolitical case that Canada is probably wishing it was not in the middle of. But this incident with the ambassador, I should just conclude, is highly unusual.
Nina
this
Maria?
Doesn't happen.
Well, I think to Susan's point, it's a much bigger issue than just about a Chinese tech company. I think the West is waking up to the reality that hostile countries may have better technology and certainly more surveillance than them. And I think also it says something about the tech world, that there are real fears that the internet or the tech world may be splitting in two. There's America and its allies on one side and China living by Chinese standards on the other side. And that's really causing great concern. I think that can't be underestimated. I mean, we're talking about the internet as a global community. You're hearing talk right now of the splinter net with China and Chinese standards and this extraordinary reach and amount of surveillance really threatening the world order.
I imagine, James, that this is the kind of thing that, as Susan said, Canada would rather not be caught in the middle of. Also, there are two Canadians who have been arrested in China.
Right. So that was the point I was going to make, is that, you know, the days after this person was arrested, this official was arrested, China seemingly retaliates by arresting two Canadians. So that's another reason Canada wishes it was in the middle of this. This is an extremely complicated issue, and it does get to concerns that the Chinese telecom companies are selling servers that are going to be able to basically surveil traffic. Congress is extremely worried about this, about these companies may own the next 5G future of the internet. And so there's that element. There's this kind of hostage taking between various officials being arrested element. And, oh, by the way, we are engaging in key trade talks with the Chinese beginning next week, that with a deadline of the end of March. And, you know, that is either will or will not, you know, defer this trade war between us and the second largest economy in the world. So extremely complicated issue with all kinds of personal as well as geopolitical implications.
Let's head south from Canada to Mexico, where the death toll from a pipeline explosion last Friday in the Hidalgo state has risen to more than 100 people. 100 people killed by a pipeline explosion. That does not include the additional 40 who were injured. Now, Susan, this has taken on a couple interesting dimensions because Mexico's president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, has come out in his response since the explosion because it's been attributed to fuel theft. And he's come out by defending the poor and those who are struggling to find employment in Mexico. It feels like there's a lot under the surface that has literally led to a human disaster.
Well, that's right. First of all, the death toll obviously is enormous. And the reason is apparently there was a break in the pipeline. People came running with buckets to get, free energy for themselves. And then this explosion occurred.
Can we just pause on that image for just one second?
That's right.
About
with
where
a
you
bucket.
Would, with a bucket. Where yeah. you would be economically to see a pipeline, a fuel pipeline, and come running over with a bucket to get fuel for your home, for your family, because the straits are just that dire.
Well, that's right. And, you know, it is this key early test because AMLO, as he's referred to, President Obrador, who just was inaugurated very recently. This is basically the first test of his administration. He's come in as a sharp course correction from his predecessor, Enrique Peña Nieto, who was known not only as a much more conservative figure. Obrador is basically a left-wing populist in terms of his politics, but also he's been much more transparent. So you have sort of these competing tensions emerging right away. On the one hand, ideology, and he's made a point of not condemning these people who were victims in this, not saying it was theft. On the other hand, can he bring in the promise of a more accountable, transparent, and possibly competent government in the future? And those things, you know, are a little bit at odds. We don't know which president will emerge as the dominant narrative of this presidency because it's so new. So I think that's why there's extra scrutiny. The other test, of course, for Mexico that is going to be the key early test has to do with dealing with us, the giant to the north. And I noticed also this week a major new agreement between Mexico and the United States having to do with asylum applicants coming over from Mexico to the United States. And the United States and the Department of Homeland Security has basically reached a deal. I think it's going to be a very controversial deal with Obrador's government to have asylum applicants remain in Mexico on the southern side of the border rather than coming here while their asylum applications are pending. This is a stark, dramatic departure from how we've handled this in the past.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you to clarify that, Susan, in terms of why it is so controversial. That's kind of the point of asylum, is that you get into
exactly.
the country where
exactly.
you're requesting asylum first, so it eliminates the immediate physical threat, supposedly.
Correct.
And then your application happens within the confines, within the protections of the asylum granting country.
Well, that's right. And I think it's significant. And again, it seems that whether there's a physical wall built or not, and there's much skepticism that remains. And certainly, I don't think anyone at this point thinks Mexico is paying for the wall since the president doesn't mention it anymore. But regardless of that, clearly you're going to have a policy legacy of these executive actions and even international agreements that the Trump administration and his DHS are forging with Mexico and other countries around the region. So you will have a lasting footprint on what looks to be a pretty sustained assault on how we've handled immigration through our southern border compared with previous administrations.
Let's talk about India. There's news that part of the Gandhi family political dynasty is the latest and youngest member of her family to enter India's political scene. Her name is Priyanka Gandhi. Her brother, Rahul Gandhi, appointed her as the party's general secretary in charge of eastern Uttar Pradesh. This comes less than 100 days before the national elections, which will determine India's leader for the next 5 years. Nina Maria, talk to us about Priyanka Gandhi. Well, what her name, I mean, obviously her name carries a lot of importance, but what about her? Is she a newcomer? Has she been around for a while and she's just emerging? Like, what's her story?
Well, she's young. She's 47. She's dynamic. She's a crowd puller. Her brother runs Congress Party, and it seems that her throwing her hat in the ring and entering active politics gives him a real chance of mounting a credible challenge to Modi. I think the real story in India, a couple of things really dominated 2018. First of all, was the Me Too story and how that exploded in India. And it'll be interesting to see how she deals with that and what her messaging is around it. The other big theme is joblessness. And the Washington Post has done some extraordinary reporting around this. And I think the youth vote is fascinating in India. On the question of jobs and the economy, the Washington Post cited this extraordinary figure, which was that the railways opened up 63,000 jobs to applicants. And of course, India is flooded with very highly educated sort of MBA graduates. Guess how many people applied? for those jobs. 63,000 jobs on offer.
How many?
19 million people applied for those jobs. And between now and 2021, the youth of India, that's the ages between 15 and 34, will reach 480 million people. So, you know, the ratings are high still for Modi. He still enjoys popular support. We've got this hugely important election. How will somebody like Priyanka Gandhi, you know, message around that?
Yeah, James, I was just going to ask you about what this means for the current Prime Minister, Narendra Modi. Do we expect Priyanka Gandhi to be, I mean, is he in political trouble right now, or does he look pretty sad?
I think the brother is, I mean, he's had some statewide victories, so I think Modi might be in for a run for his money, and that was not expected as recently as earlier last year. I mean, he was very popular. But I think the signs are starting to show, you know, the Gandhi name is extremely powerful in India. So I think that there is that election is shaking up to be a cliffhanger, possibly.
Let me get to a few more quick comments about some of the stories we've discussed thus far. With regards to Venezuela, David is listening in Minnesota. David writes, this is no different than all the other U.S. coups that the U.S. has orchestrated with regards to the U.S.'s involvement. Dictators are only dictators if they don't agree with the U.S. and they have oil that U.S. companies want. And with regards to the World Economic Forum in Davos, Spitfish tweeted, listening to 1A, and I have to confess, I genuinely thought Davos was one of the kingdoms in Game of Thrones. Come on, man. You got to know more than that. You know that if you're listening, but that's glad we could correct that for you. Glad we could get that straight. One more story that caught our attention. Netflix and Hulu, if you're documentary fans, you may already know this, but they've been telling the story of the ill-planned fire festival in the Bahamas last year. They each released documentaries this month showing how thousands of festival goers were duped for thousands of dollars each. The planners made victims out of many, including the Bahamians who physically built the festival grounds and local business owners. Restaurant owner Marianne Roll was in the Netflix documentary. She spent $50,000 from her life savings to pay her workers. This week, Roll started a GoFundMe campaign asking for $123,000 for her expenses. She asked for $123,000 in 1 week. She's raised nearly $190,000. Now, the festival fascinates me for a lot of reasons. I gotta say, I know we gotta go soon, but it just feels like one of those Rorschach tests about how you feel about the young, rich, wealthy playboys of 2017, 18, 19, and what they do with their money.
You're looking at me here. You know, you're the expert. You tell us.
I don't know. Well, I mean, it kind of galvanized people, Nina Maria, about the way that these festivals kind of prey on the super rich and those who don't really Google people well before they spend money on a festival.
I have to confess that I'm above 40 years old and probably not the greatest expert on this, but I did follow it loosely and yeah, I mean, sort of an extraordinary story, but I really, I'm so sorry.
Well, just to give you a sense of what this was like before we go, that's okay. I will be the ranking youngin' in the room. Here's some of the music from the festival's promotional video, because the director of marketing wrote this email about how it needed to push the sonic boundary. So this may give you a sense of what Fire Festival was like. As we say thank you to Susan Glasser, staff writer at The New Yorker. Thanks, Susan.
Oh, great to be here.
Nina Maria Potts, director of global news coverage for Feature Story News. Thank you, Nina Maria.
Thank you.
And James Kitfield, senior fellow at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. Thanks, James.
Thanks, Joshua.
1A senior producers are Gay Bullard, Denise Couture, Danielle Knight, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. To learn more about them and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org/staff. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening, and enjoy your weekend. This is 1A. ¶¶